try to become a bull." He looked at Serena, looked right into those eyes of hers, and said, "I've descended." He decided not to mention the foxes or the wolves. "I've descended to a certain level, but I'm going to get back up. I'll deal with it all." Serena, with her hands still on her hips, looked at him as if he were senile, and shook her head and spun about and marched out of the room. No, Charlie was no bull who had grown up with a consciousness of his own powers. He didn't have a back like a Jersey bull any longer, and his only hope of getting one was in that book in the hands of a boy who stood beside the chair in his nurse's aide outfit, that slim boy who, unaccountably, had the forearms and hands of a man twice his size. The boy was like the man he told him about, Cleanthes, who had a job as a day laborer, but impressed all who came in contact with him like a hill-bred lion, trusting in his might. Like Ulysses washed ashore, wherever the hell it was Ulysses was washed ashore, and whoever the hell he was. The name summoned up a flicker of memory, but that was all. It was humiliating, the way she had talked to him right in front of Connie. He had never let a woman talk to him that way. So why now? Because the source of his strength had always been his money, his reputation, his success in worldly affairs. But the one true source of strength was his own might, his own will, to get or to avoid, his own divine spark of reason, which enabled him to judge which things were in his power and which were beyond it. Well, Serena wasn't a rich woman. Not without him, she wasn't. They had a prenuptial agreement and all the rest of it. And she wasn't exactly a despot, but she sure could be a bitch. And there you had that little performance in front of Connie. Even though the very thought of it made him feel miserable, he said, "Connie, I think I'm going to get up and take a walk. Give me a hand. Get me my bathrobe." Getting the knee off the bed and upright was a killer, but finally he was out in the hallway, clad in his blue robe and supported by his aluminum crutches. The hallway was heavily carpeted, but the crutches went clack-clack, 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 all the same. Connie walked beside him. Clack-clack, clack-clack. "Connie," said the old man.
"Yes, sir."
"Connie, I want you to do me a favor."
"If I can, Mr. Croker."
"You'll be coming back here tomorrow at 8, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, what I want is, I want you to leave the book with me after you finish work today, and I'll do some reading on my own and give it back to you tomorrow morning."
The boy's eyes grew frightened, wary, and startled. He stood there with his mouth open. He didn't know what to say. There was no way he could explain to the old man that the book was alive with the spark of Zeus. Therein were the essential truths that had enabled him to withstand the worst the beasts could throw at him in jail, withstand exile from his own family, alienation from the law, a confrontation with a thug. He could see the sneering face of the greaser at the gardener's. And in that moment it all came together. He could see it as a foreordained pattern. The book had arrived, seemingly by accident, at Santa Rita, and introduced him to Zeus, to Epictetus, and the truth and the way, and given him the courage to fight and overcome the worst predators in the jail. Then Zeus uprooted the entire jail and cracked it open like a walnut shell, so that he could escape. Then he made the army reservist's jeep available, and somehow led him to Kenny and Mai and the underground airline, and sent him to Atlanta. And why Atlanta? Because in a hopelessly cluttered attic room, in a little town he had never heard of in his life, Chambly, there was a copy of the book. And why should he have a copy of the book? To continue the work and testify to the glory of Zeus. And now he had a chance. The very scalp of his head grew hot from the thought. Now he had a chance to convert a man of money and power and renown. From the moment he was laid off by Kroger Global Foods to this moment, standing beside a crippled Charlie Kroger, this—but of course, this had been the pattern his life had been woven into. Not to punish Kroger for throwing hundreds of people out of work with a snap of his fingers, but to recruit him and all his resources into the service of Zeus. To Charlie it seemed as if the boy stood there beside him for 5 minutes without saying a word. He looked as if he were off on a cloud somewhere. What the hell was the big deal about the book? "All right, Mr. Kroger," the boy said finally. "I'll leave it with you when I go. But please look after it. Remember, it's alive."
Alive? Charlie didn't know what the hell that was supposed to mean, but there was no mistaking the drift of what the boy had said.
Chapter 31 Roger Black. All at once it occurred to Roger that the very first time he had come here to City Hall to talk to Wes about Farik Fannin and Elizabeth Armholster, Wes was the one who hopped up and started pacing this brown and white Yoruba and Phoenix rug with a puzzled but halogen-like gleam in his eye. And this time it was him. Oh, yes, Roger not a bit too white. He couldn't stay seated. He kept marching up and down all those deep-piled, tall-tufted birds, the phoenixes, with the adrenaline flowing. He felt as if his eyes were burning brighter and brighter with his gradually dawning awareness of his new role in life. Not a bit too white. As for Wes, he remained seated in his armchair, his excitement, if any, over the new Roger successfully contained. "So I just opened the screen door and walked in," said Roger. "Then I walked right up to him. He was standing there on his crutches with this attendant, or whatever he was, a white kid. And I was no farther from him than I am from you right now, and I said, 'This isn't a game, my friend. Are you going to appear at the press conference, or are we going to videotape your statement, or neither? If it's neither, my friend, a lot of things will have to be changed, starting with Planner's Bank.'"
Wes said, "Did you really keep calling him my friend?"
"Well, maybe not quite that often, but that's what I called him."
"Okay," said the mayor, "go ahead."
"He didn't say anything at first," said Roger, "and so I said, 'Do you understand? Do you understand?' And finally this little peep comes out of this great big man."
"Yes."
"That's the way he said it."
"Yes."
"The great 60-minute man. Makes you wonder, the way some of these so-called powerful business interests turn out to be when you actually confront them. I said to him, 'You've made a commitment to me, and I've been assuring the mayor you'll be there. This press conference is going to be a crucial moment for the city. I said, you double-cross me, and the mayor, it won't be pleasant. You know that, don't you?'" Meek as a kitten, he says,
"I know that."
That's the way he was talking. "I know that." "You had to be there, Wes." Even as he spoke, it occurred to Roger that he was embroidering the scene more than a tiny bit. But he decided that a little enhancing of the truth was justified in this instance, since it helped make up for the missing emotion, tension, and drama of the scene as it had actually occurred.
"Christ," said Wes, "I hope the son of a bitch isn't in such bad shape he's a basket case at the press conference." Uh-oh, he'd gone too far. He hastened to reassure the mayor.
"Well, not at all, Wes, not at all. It's just that Kroger, if you ask me, is your typical bully. When his bluff is called, he folds."
"So you feel sure he'll turn up for the press conference?" said the mayor.
"Oh, absolutely," said Roger. "He knows that if he doesn't, it all goes." He snapped his fingers.
Like that. The plantation, the big house in Buckhead. Incidentally, I wish you could set foot inside Croker's place. There's this entry hall, or lobby, or whatever you call it, that's bigger in square feet than most people's entire houses. I really wish you could see it. The house is worth probably $3 or $4 million in the current market. He'll sing any song you want before he'll give up the kind of life he's living now. Croker Concourse, the buildings in Midtown, this wholesale food operation he has, it's all going to go if he doesn't come to that press conference. All right, said Wes, but just for good measure, keep prodding him and reminding him, because I really do need the son of a bitch. Oh, don't worry about that, Wes, said Roger. He's going to get daily reminders, and if I have to, I'll march right back into his house. The mayor looked up at Roger, who was still pacing, and smiled broadly without saying a thing. Roger stopped and looked down at the mayor and asked, "What's funny?" "You're really enjoying politics, aren't you?" said the mayor. "Politics?" "That's what all this is, Roger, everything you've been doing. It's politics as it's actually conducted. Oh, please don't get me wrong. I'm immensely grateful for what you've already done. I mean that. All I'm saying is that it gives me pleasure to see you enjoying politics as much as I do. There's nothing else in this world like it." Roger was busy mining Wes's remarks for irony, but all he said was, "I still don't know what you're talking about." Wes said, "Do you know what politicians really love about politics? What makes politics so hard to give up once you've had a taste of it?" "Oh, I don't know. Power? Fame? Money?" Wes laughed. "It's certainly not money. Anybody who goes into politics to make money has to be an idiot. I know some idiots have done precisely that, but it's a stupid thing to try. Me, I actually lose money every year because on my salary I can't do all the things I'm expected to do. And it's not power, if by power you mean the power to get things done. Change the life of the city, reduce crime, rehabilitate the South Side, all those things. And it's not fame. You quickly get used to publicity. You get used to seeing yourself on television, seeing your picture in the newspaper, even to having a special in-depth segment done about you on the NBC Nightly News or articles written about you in national magazines or the New York Times. You start to take all that as nothing more than a natural part of your life, your role. You start looking at it as something that's just there, like the sky, the sun, the clouds, the night, the moon, the stars, the traffic on Georgia 400. No, what really gets you, what really grabs you, what really turns you into a political junkie is seeing them jump."
"Seeing them jump?"
"Exactly. Seeing them jump. Sometimes they're literally jumping up. Anytime I walk into a room, at least in Atlanta, everybody who's sitting down is going to jump up, even if it's the so-called business interests, which is our current euphemism for prominent white people. When it's time for me to sit down, somebody is going to jump to get me a chair. People in stores, not that I go shopping very often, they drop whatever else they're doing and jump to see to it I have whatever I want. On that score, white people are no different from African Americans."
"You've started saying African American?" asked Roger.
"Oh, yes," said the mayor. "Anyway," he continued, "if I'm going out to the airport to catch a flight, and I'm running late, they'll stop the whole damned airport to make sure I catch my flight, if that's what it takes. And if I'm walking through a public space, whether it's here near City Hall or out at the airport or wherever, people, white people, will jump to get near me and coo the sweet nothings of fandom and ask for my autograph. Roger, that's what's addictive about politics. Seeing 'em jump. And that's what you've had a little taste of. Or a big taste. Charlie Croker has always been a big player in Atlanta, and you've had him jumping ever since you first went to see him in his office at Croker Concourse. So far, you've been a great politician, and you've done something very valuable for me and for your client. That having been said, it's fun, isn't it? It's fun!
Roger frowned. That was a skill Wes had, striking close to the bone before you even knew he was about to thrust. And as usual, Roger resented him even more for being right. Wes was always two steps ahead of him when it came to things like understanding human motivation, and Roger was in no mood to forgive him for it.
"I don't know that I'd call it fun," he said, more crossly than he meant to.
"Well, anyway, you've done great work, Counselor. Having Croker at that press conference is going to mean more to your client and to this city than you can possibly imagine. I didn't tell you, but we had a riot on our hands last night."
"A riot?"
"Exactly. A bunch of the usual homies are out on the street on English Avenue, and they're talking shit about how their hero, Farik the Cannon Fannin, has been framed by this wealthy white girl. And their emotions rise, and they start heading over toward the World Congress Center, yelling and breaking windows. And then they made their mistake. They saw a bunch of white men working late on that new construction over there, and so they decided on a little brawling and pillaging. Their mistake was they went after the wrong white working men. These white guys were the wire lathers. They're the white guys you see at these building sites with hard hats, 5-day growths of beard, paunches, and sleeveless T-shirts, out of which protrude their 18- and 20-inch biceps. They'd just as soon brawl as drink beer. Either one's okay with them. 5 minutes later, there was no more riot. The riot had been out-rioted, thank God. I called Eliu Yale, the police chief, and told him to put an absolute lid on the whole thing, and nobody in the press ever got wind of it. But that shows you where we are right now. We're nearing the boiling point. Students have been making speeches at Morehouse, and Spelman, for that matter. The so-called Morehouse elite is all for solidarity on an issue like this, if there's ever been an issue like this. They're all convinced that Fannin was set up and framed.
Is that what you believe?
Not if you use framed to mean a plot that's hatched ahead of time. If you mean framed in the sense of did she use the R-word as an on-the-spot excuse when her girlfriends find her bawling a 225-pound African-American, that I find believable. That's Farik the Cannon story, and it's believable.
I'm sorry, said Roger, but it strikes me as funny hearing you use the term African-American after all the things you said about Jesse Jackson.
The mayor put on his ironic smile.
As I told you, times change and things change. When Jesse hits a home run, there's no use grousing about it. There's nothing to do but record the score. Come on, sit down. You're making me nervous.
The mayor gestured toward the couch. Roger, not a bit too white, sat down, but before he knew it, he was on his feet again, pacing the phoenix rug, looking at the patterns that the ivory Yoruban ceremonial swords made against the ebony paneling, and musing to Wes about Charlie Croker and how he wouldn't be happy until he saw him jump straight through the hoop. Charlie had always used the term below the gnat line as a piece of down-home humor. But this time it didn't strike him as funny. As he hobbled on his aluminum crutches from the Cadillac toward the big house, black gnats were dive-bombing his eyes in waves, without any let-up. Why the eyes? Probably the water. They wanted to drink the water out of his eyes. Because of the crutches, he couldn't lift his hands high enough to shoo them away. Now he could hear them singing in his ears. Turpentine was not the place to be in the summertime. In the summertime, South Georgia bowed down helplessly, abjectly, to her rulers, the insects.
"Ow!" That was Serena, who was just behind him. "Charlie, a bee stung me!"
"Wasn't a bee," said Charlie, without looking around. "It's a fly." "Probably a black fly," thought Charlie. "Mean little bastards.
They were mottled, mostly black, in an unhealthy-looking way, and their wings were swept back like a jet fighter's or a stealth bomber's. They never missed. But it could have been a yellow fly or a horse fly. All three of them stung, but there was no need to go into all that with Serena. He turned his head about and said, "Heidi, cover up the baby's face with something." He almost never referred to her as Kingsley. "You don't worry, Mr. Croker," said Heidi. "I hold her close to me, and I have chiffon." Serena again. "Charlie, damn it, another one. How can a fly... How can a... Damn it, Charlie, another one." Charlie knew that sound from way back before the first word he ever knew. It was the sound of a human being, a hopelessly slow species, trying to blow the gnat swarms away from her eyes in Baker County in the summertime. "Ugh!" That was Connie carrying the bags and bringing up the rear, muttering to himself. No doubt the flies attacked him, too, but he was the stoic. Shit! One of them got Charlie in the back of the neck, and they still had another 30 feet to go before they reached the front door. "Charlie," said Serena, "what are these little white things? They're disgusting." Charlie saw them, too. Another mottled fly, but mottled white instead of black. "They're privy flies," he said. "They won't hurt you." "What are privy flies?" "They swarm around privies." "What's a privy?" "An outhouse."
"That's disgusting. Ugh! I just stepped on something disgusting, too."
A foul odor rose from the path as these wayfarers struggled through the Badlands in the kingdom of the insects. "There's millipedes on the walkway. That's what you smell there. Try not to step on 'em."
"Mr. Croker," said Heidi, "what happened to tree?"
Charlie craned his head about and saw her holding the baby with one arm and pointing with the other toward a maple tree. The branches appeared to be festering with some dreadful disease. "Tent caterpillars," said Charlie. They had infested the entire tree. They would strip it bare of leaves before they were through.
"That sound," said Serena, "is that the sound of them eating?"
"Yep," said Charlie. They did make a sort of crunch, crunch sound. In fact, it was the sound of them defecating, the sound of the droppings of tens of thousands of tent caterpillars hitting the ground. But no use introducing that piece of information when there's still 15 feet to go before reaching the front door. And no use mentioning that now, in June, in Baker County, right over there, in the shade beneath the live oaks and the magnolias, there'll be mosquitoes, jumbo mosquitoes, thoroughbreds of the family Culicity, right in the middle of the day. It wasn't far from here to Juker's Swamp, where the mosquitoes multiplied by the billions in June and grew up looking for blood to suck. And no use calling attention to that old live oak stump over there in the shade. Try sitting on that for a moment to rest your weary bones and get a little respite from the sun, or try lying down on this nice soft bed of pine tags over here. The mosquitoes, yellow flies, horse flies, black flies, and gnats will attack from above, and the chiggers will be after your ankles, your thighs, your neck, and your big unsuspecting bottom faster than you can pronounce the word. June was the chiggers' month. For the chiggers, June was Thanksgiving, Christmas, and the 4th of July all rolled into one. Nothing those vicious, fiery red mites liked better than a human bottom sitting on a tree stump in June. A single chigger bite would give you a red welt that would burn and itch for a week. God almighty, it was hot. The cicadas were up in the trees rattling away. They were big, as bugs went, the cicadas were. 1.5 inches long, some of them. And ugly, too. And noisy. In Baker County,
when the sun reaches its zenith in June, and the cicadas descend on the trees and start that damned rattle of theirs, and you can't get the vibrations out of your eardrums, that's when you start seeing the monkey, as the field hands used to say. That was Charlie right now. The black gnats and three kinds of swept-wing flies were after him, and it was hot as hell, and he was seeing the monkey. He glanced over his shoulder, and Connie was right behind him, carrying in the bags. Connie had done the driving, and he, Charlie, had sat in the back seat with Serena. Frankly, Connie had made him half crazy, because he wouldn't go more than 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, or maybe 10. Christ, it was bad enough to have to drive all the way from Atlanta. Durwood and the boys would start buzzing about that, all right. Cap'n Charlie always came to Turpentine by airplane. Not always the G-5, sometimes the beach jet, but always by airplane. What could he say? The bad leg made it too hard to go up and down the beach jet's stairs? Ah, the hell with it. He wasn't obliged to explain anything to anybody, although he felt a tremendous need to. The big house was set in a grove of live oaks, magnolias, and dogwoods. The white blossoms of the magnolias had never been more profuse or more lush. But with the magnolias, it wasn't just the blossoms that got you. There were also the leaves, long, thick, deep green leaves, each one of which shone as if it had been waxed and polished by hand. The branches came all the way down to the ground, and the tops rose to a point like a Christmas tree. And when you saw a dozen of them arranged on either side of the big house like this, it made you catch your breath, no matter how many times you had seen them before. The porch, which went almost all the way around the house, was about 4 feet above the ground, and the Confederate roses had grown on the trellises below the porch in such masses of blossoms it seemed as if the house had been built atop a vast mound of flowers. Inside the house it was liable to be musty, since he hadn't used it for several weeks, and no place on earth was hotter and more humid than Baker County, Georgia, in the summertime. Thank God he had put in central air conditioning 10, or was it 11, years ago, back when a $110,000 HVAC system seemed like nothing, a mere routine expense. Now he couldn't put together $110,000 to buy anything. God, if only he didn't feel so tired. He never slept anymore. He was dead tired from the moment he got up in the morning. He didn't want to get up, not for a minute. He only got up because he knew Serena would break his balls if he didn't, that and the fact that he would look bad in Connie's eyes. So, clack, 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 he made his way to the front stairs that led up to the porch. He looked at the stairs and delivered himself of a great sigh. "Want me to give you a hand, Mr. Croker?" asked Connie.
"No," said Charlie. "I was just—" Great weariness. "I was just—I don't know what I was just doing," said Charlie.
"You were just feeling sorry for yourself, Charlie," said Serena. "That's what you were just doing. If you'd put that much energy into doing your therapy, you could be over all this."
By now she was right beside him. She wore a pair of white linen slacks that tapered down to a narrow cuff over the ankle, and a white silk blouse with yellow candy stripes. She was trying to chase the gnats away from her big blue eyes. She didn't have to say another word. It was plain that she resented this escape to Turpentine. This was the last place in the world she would choose to be in the summer. Charlie started up the stairs unaided. Clack, 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 clack.
"Why do they make that noise, Charlie?" she said with exasperation, brushing her hand in front of her eyes about 90 times a minute.
"Why does who make which noise?" asked Charlie,
obviously peeved.
"That clack, 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 clack."
"Well, that's just the—"
"It's not just anything, Charlie. It's those crutches."
"There's nothing—"
Are they loose? Were they clattering that way when you got them?
I don't know, I suppose.
Well, let's just get inside before we all get bitten to death.
By now Serena was flailing her hand before her eyes and screwing her face up into a Serena epitome of frustrated anger. So Charlie headed up the stairs. Clack, 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 clack. Every clack, clack now sounded to Charlie like a pair of rifle shots. He was dead tired. His knee hurt like hell. His brain felt as if it were the black part of a tornado. He was seeing the monkey. And his wife didn't like the way his crutches sounded. His crutches! If he had had the energy and the confidence he used to have, he would have cut off that line of remarks in an instant. As it was, her observations about aluminum crutches became yet more trash sucked up by the tornado in his skull. The big house had always had a decor that was more feminine than not. There were a lot of Chinese yellow walls with delicate, spidery white plaster moldings in the Adam mode, as Ronald Vine had called it, whatever that actually meant. These were apparently the original decorations of the house, so much a part of a bygone era that no one, not even Ronald, had ever dared alter them. After all, bygone era was very much on the mind of anyone who bought a South Georgia quail plantation. As a result, the house also still had things, such as sliding pocket doors with elaborately etched glass windows, with which you could close off the dining room from the back parlor, and bays in the front and back parlors with four windows each, two of which had curved frames with curved glass to match. The interior of the big house was where the woman, presumably the wife, could express her taste and refinement. The rest of the place was given over to man the hunter. Even though it was on no more than 4 hours' notice, Durwood had managed to soldier up a house staff for Cap'n Charlie. Antibella would be there, along with two assistant cooks, and Mason would be there with a couple of the boys to help out with errands, lifting, and such like. And, of course, Durwood himself would be around. And Connie would be there. So it wasn't exactly that Cap'n Charlie had been left to his own devices. With Connie's help, he had had himself ensconced in an easy chair in the big house's den, as it was called, the room that had been the big house's mail redoubt before Charlie had built the gunhouse. Compared to the big room of the gunhouse, the den looked positively effete. No boar's heads, no stuffed snakes, no battalions of upright guns. Instead, a rather subtle form of paneling. Heart of virgin pine, with some school of Audubon paintings of quail adorning it. Charlie found the den peaceful. The roof of the porch outside shielded you from the sun. It was soothing. Heart of virgin pine and quail paintings were fine. He didn't particularly want to be reminded of tusks and fangs right now. He picked up the book. Connie was off with Durwood, with Charlie's blessing, taking a look at the plantation, or at least the outbuildings and the kennels and the horses. He opened the book at random to a passage that said, "Just as every skill is strengthened by practice, so is every bad habit made worse by repetition. If you lie in bed for 10 days, and then get up and try to take a walk, you will see how quickly your legs have lost their strength." Christ Almighty, Epictetus had been reading his mail. He had come as close to lying in bed for 10 days as they'd let him, and it was true. His legs had no strength left. His eyes came to rest on a painting of a covey of quail hiding in a huddle of tall grass. The artist had managed to make it look as if the birds were all crouching, frightened, ready to explode upward at the first sign of danger. That was what he, Charlie, was like now, hiding, crouched, in the tall grass, panicked to the point of taking off in any direction. All right, suppose he went to the press conference and told the truth about Farik Fanon. Suppose he said that Fanon is the epitome of the arrogant, obnoxious, swaggering athlete who thinks he is elevated above ordinary standards of right and wrong. As soon as the words passed his lips, his worldly possessions would be gone, and he'd be branded as a racist bigot. He was still staring at the covey of quail when Serena materialized in the doorway. She came toward Charlie with a smile he couldn't decipher. Pleasure? Sarcasm? He couldn't tell. She sat down in an easy chair near his and said,
"So, how does it feel to be back at Turpentine?"
Charlie couldn't read her expression or weigh her words at all. "It's relaxing," he said finally.
"Relaxing from what?" said Serena.
When he made no response, she said,
"Do you mind if I ask you something?"
"Go ahead."
"What is going on, this whole business with Mr. Roger White?"
"Well..."
"And don't just tell me that he's trying to get you involved in some case of his. That doesn't make sense, because here is this man who dares to come marching into our house uninvited and insisting you give him an answer about something or other. The Charlie Croker I married would have picked him up bodily and thrown him out. I couldn't stand to see you cringing like that."
Charlie stared at her for a moment. "Well, you're right. This is a lot more than I've made it out to be. In fact, it's a mess." He didn't trust Serena, didn't trust his own wife, who had married him for better, not for better or for worse, with the information he was about to impart to her. He sighed and then resolved to tell her anyway. After all, she was his wife and had a right to know. He told her step by step. Lawyer Roger White's initial offer to trade him freedom from Planners Bank's bankruptcy machinery in exchange for a flattering public statement about Farik Fannin, Georgia Tech's Charlie Croker of today. How White had demonstrated his side's power to keep Planners Bank on a leash. His appalling meeting with Farik Fannin, who got in as many insults and contemptuous snorts as possible. How he wrestled with the angels over the whole dilemma. How could he betray Inman, especially after volunteering to help in any way he could in having Fannin punished for what he had done? But how could he turn down such a fairly innocuous way of saving his entire empire from certain ruin? Besides, he would be doing something for the entire city by calming troubled waters. The Journal Constitution would no doubt give him a pat on the back for that. But Inman would be furious, and everybody who knew and liked Inman, which was a lot of people, would smell something fishy. And did he, Charlie, think Fannin was capable of raping Elizabeth Armholster? He wouldn't put it past him for a minute. He told her how he swayed this way and that, wrestled with the angels, and finally called Lawyer White, who had turned out to be pretty obnoxious himself, and said yes, he agreed to the bargain. And how, ever since then, Lawyer White had treated him in the most condescending manner you could imagine. How he, Charlie, who used to pride himself on making decisions and then putting the dilemmas behind him, was getting nowhere with this one. On the one hand, if he came out in favor of Fannin, he would save all his possessions and be safe from the bank, but lose all his friends, the Piedmont Driving Club set, and every other set. But if he refused, he would lose all his possessions, right down to the house they lived in and the cars they drove. And they would still lose all their friends, because the sort of friends they had made were the sort who couldn't stand people who couldn't afford to go out and blow $300 on dinner for four at Mordecai's. His dilemma was just as hopeless as it had ever been. All the while, as he told the story, Serena stared at him, with her left elbow resting on an arm of the chair and one side of her face resting on the heel of her hand. She scarcely even blinked. But toward the end, she began to smile ever so slightly.
It was a benign smile, however. When, at last, he finished, Serena surprised him. Instead of acting angry, sarcastic, or put out, she took the heel of her hand away from her face and rested her weight on her forearm and smiled, sweetly, and said in a sweet, low voice,
"Charlie, I only wish you'd told me all this before. This is a terrible thing to have bottled up inside yourself."
"Well, really it is.
And you probably thought there was no one who could possibly help you, and therefore you didn't want anyone to know."
"Well, that's true," said Charlie. "When I think how I told Inman I'd do anything I could to help him, shook his hand, practically swore a blood oath. On the other hand, I'm 60 years old, and I'm about to be wiped out."
"Charlie."
"They've already taken the airplanes, 3 of the cars, and you know what would—"
"Charlie."
"Would be next."
"Charlie."
"What?" Once she had his attention, she returned to the small, soft, intimate voice.
"I have something to tell you that may make it easier for you."
Charlie looked at her, seriously doubting that what she said was true, but all he said was, "What is it?"
"Elizabeth made me swear I wouldn't tell anyone, not even you."
"Elizabeth?"
"Elizabeth Armholster. I told her, but I don't care, Charlie. This is something you have to know."
He just stared at her.
"You remember that night at the driving club? The night you and Inman went off into the ballroom and had a talk?"
"Yeah," said Charlie, with a resigned twist to his lips. "I remember. That was the night I swore to Inman I'd back him up in this thing." He shook his head.
"Well, before you start thinking you're bound by some sacred oath, did you know I had a talk with Elizabeth that same night, at the dining club?"
"I remember you going off into the bamboo room with her."
"Exactly. And you want to know what she told me?"
"What?"
"About that night? That Friday night of Freaknik?" "She hooked up with Fannin."
"She what?"
"Hooked up with him."
She gave Charlie the sort of stare, accompanied by a slight parting of the lips, that you give people when you're unveiling a major revelation. "What's hooked up?"
"You don't know hooked up? That's something boys and girls do now. You really never heard of it?"
"No."
"Well, today they don't talk about dates anymore. They go out in groups, a group of girls over here and a group of boys over there, all looking for a party. To find a party, you go to places where boys and girls hang out, such as the rec room."
"What's that?"
"It's a restaurant near the Tech campus. The rec room, as in the Ramblin' Rec. So here are 5 girls, including Elizabeth, squeezed into a booth. And it's after 11, and they're still looking for a party. The next thing they know, 4 black students slide into the booth opposite them. And everybody in the restaurant knows who one of them is. Farik Fannin. Pretty soon, Fannin and his friends are hitting on the white girls. But it's all very playful, not crude or suggestive."
"Hitting on?"
"Flirting with. Coming on to. That's what they say now, hitting on. Elizabeth said she and her friends, didn't want to appear standoffish, since everybody in the restaurant is looking at them, and Fannin is Tech's poster boy, and so forth and so on. Anyway, Fannin says there's a party going on at his apartment, which isn't all that far away. Naturally, you can say in hindsight, that should have started the girl's thinking. If there's a party going on at his apartment, what's he doing here? But the fact is, Elizabeth and 2 of the girls decided to go to the party."
"What about the other 2? Said Charlie.
"They said, not me, and went home. One thing you ought to realize, Charlie, Elizabeth's not a bashful girl. She'll take you up on a dare. In certain ways she's like Inman, or, for that matter, Ellen, who I think is a holy terror. So the three girls arrive at Fannin's apartment, and, of course, there's nobody there. Elizabeth says, "I thought you said there's a party." To which Fannin says, "Well, now there is." So now the boys and the girls have found a party, and that's when the hooking up can begin.
"But what the hell does it mean?" said Charlie.
"That's what I'm getting to. The party's in progress, people are drinking, and a boy is attracted to a particular girl. Or a girl is attracted to a particular boy. Remember one thing, Charlie, it can happen that way, too. The girl can start it. And one of them nods toward the back, or wherever there's an empty room, and right there, on the spur of the moment, the two of them go to that room and hook up."
"But what?"
"I'm telling you," said Serena, in the same soft, confidential voice. "It always refers to sex, but it can be anything from kissing, along with, you know, some feeling up, to going all the way, in which case it's called majorly hooking up. Now, I'd heard of all that, but Elizabeth introduced me to a term I'd never heard of. She's 10 years younger than I am, so I'd never heard of it. And that's score."
"Score?"
"Not scored with, but just score. It used to be that boys would brag about scoring with some girl, meaning getting her to go all the way. But score is a word girls use. A girl will say, 'I scored Jack last night,' as if she's gotten the guy to go all the way, and it's a terrific accomplishment. So anyway, Elizabeth hooked up with Fannin. They went into his bedroom."
"Jesus Christ," said Charlie. "He asked her, or she asked him?"
"She says he asked her, but, Charlie, I'm not so sure."
"God almighty. What did she say went on?"
"She says she didn't have anything but a little mild hooking up on her mind. But she'd been drinking, and things progressed a lot more majorly than she'd intended. Meanwhile, the other two girls, her friends, they're not having a very terrific time. They want to go home, but they don't want to leave Elizabeth behind. By now, according to Elizabeth, her underpants are off, and Fannin is trying to get on top of her, and she's protesting. She's saying no. She doesn't want to go all the way. But Fannin, this is Elizabeth talking, Fannin used his superior strength and shoved her back flat on the bed and had his way with her. Just about that time the door opens, and it's the other two girls looking for her, and she starts saying, 'Make him stop. Get him off me.'"
"Jesus God," said Charlie. "Had the guy actually penetrated?"
"I don't know," said Serena. "I couldn't bring myself to ask her that. But I don't believe her version of how it happened in the first place. I think she was just drunk enough to decide she wanted to score Farik Fannin. I can't think of any other reason why a girl would let a man remove her underpants."
"You mean?"
"If you want to know what I think she was the one who gave him the eye to hook up. And she ended up doing exactly what she had in mind."
"Are you saying?"
"Exactly," said Serena. "I think the only reason this whole rape business got started was she was surprised by those two girls and had to come up with a quick explanation. And so she said, 'Make him stop, and get him off me,' or whatever it was she said. You'll notice she didn't say anything to Inman and Ellen. Not at first she didn't."
"She didn't?"
"Not at first. It was one of the girls' mothers, Tanya Bear's mother, who called Ellen and Inman and got them so crazed. Tanya Bear had told her mother about it. So now Elizabeth was stuck with her story. But she didn't want her parents to tell anybody, not the police, not the university, not anybody. And why? She said she was too traumatized to talk to anybody about it. If you want my opinion, she knew that she had concocted on the spur of the moment something that was turning into a gigantic lie. She was afraid to even try filling in the details for a rape charge and actually bring it before the police or a court or somebody. What she was really telling her parents and everybody else was, "Let's forget about it. Please, let's forget about it." But she has the wrong father, if that's what she thought was going to happen. So Inman's going around, furiously trying to pull his troops together. But he can't bring any charges because his daughter's so traumatized. Some traumatized. She wasn't acting traumatized that night at the driving club.
"I thought you said you liked Elizabeth."
"I do," said Serena. "She's fun. We get along well. She confides in me."
"But do I think she's an angel?"
"No, I don't." "You don't understand women, Charlie. You really don't. Man at his most conniving is no match for woman at hers. From the very beginning, Elizabeth has tried to put a lid on this whole affair without ever admitting to Inman and Ellen that she was anything other than little Miss Innocent. And now it's gotten totally out of hand. Fannin's name is all over television and the newspapers. You don't see Elizabeth's name. You just see, 'Daughter of one of Atlanta's most powerful businessmen.' But her name's all over the Internet, thanks to this website, Chasing the Dragon. And I don't know anybody who can't tell you right off the bat that it's Elizabeth Armholster." Serena's eyes were boring into Charlie's.
"All right," he said, "let's assume all this is true. Where does it leave me?"
"It's more, where does it leave Fannin?" said Serena. "He's the one who stands to lose everything over some trumped-up accusations."
"So I should—"
"You should give him a break, Charlie. You don't have to attack Elizabeth. You don't even have to mention her. Not even as the daughter of a prominent whatever. You just tell everybody to give Fannin the benefit of the doubt, because you know the hazards of sports celebrity, which you do."
Charlie turned his head and stared up at the old pine paneling of the den and sighed.
"Charlie," said Serena, in order to get him looking at her once more, "it's not a question of making Fannin and his side happy. It's a question of coming down on the side of the truth. I'm telling you, I know Elizabeth, and she's perfectly capable of hooking up with any boy as famous as Farik Fannin, black or not, and scoring him. You can't say that, of course. You just give Fannin a little bit of a shield. It would be true, and it would be the right thing to do."
Charlie leaned back in the chair and put his head down and began breathing audibly through his mouth. The dilemma now roared in his head more furiously than ever. He wanted to believe what Serena had just told him. He wanted to be on the side of righteousness as well as the side of Charlie Croker's bankrupt empire. He wanted to believe that Serena was devoted to truth and fair play, and only incidentally to the preservation of Mr. and Mrs. Charles Croker's assets. As if sensing she almost had him, Serena leaned toward him and said,
"Right now this is a hot piece of gossip. But 6 months, a year from now, who's going to remember the details? Who's going to remember that Charlie Croker made a generic statement about athletes and the pressure put upon them? Nobody."
Charlie could think of somebody. He could see that swarthy, fat face and that black hair combed straight back from low on his forehead and plastered down like a swath of asphalt. He could hear that low, angry, camel's-cured voice. He could see those small, unforgiving eyes.
"I know they've got their own agenda," said Serena, "but this Roger White is absolutely right when he says you will be doing something for the city of Atlanta. Doing a lot for it. If you stand up and say, 'Let's hold on a second. Let's take a breath. Let's not have a rush to judgment.' That's all you'll really be saying. 'Let's not have a rush to judgment.' And given what I know about Elizabeth, and what a lot of other people know about her, Elizabeth's not exactly tight-lipped. Somebody needs to say that.
Somebody like you.
The mayor can't do it all by himself. But the two of you together, you'd be making an appeal across racial lines. In the long run, people will praise you. Most people, no matter what they knew about Elizabeth, would take the easy way out and say nothing.
It takes courage to do what you're going to do.
You won't be taking sides, you'll just be leveling out the playing field a little bit.
Yes, thought Charlie, black people will praise me. The Herb Richmonds of Atlanta will praise me. At the Piedmont Driving Club, he could see the porte cochere and the front entrance and the doorman, Gates helping some tall, teetering white man out of his Mercedes 600. Maybe Lamprey. Just as if he were right in front of him, he could see Arthur Lamprey's great height and bent over dog's neck. And Lamprey would know that something smelled high in this situation, since he had been pressured, by whom, by someone, into calling the dogs off Charlie and his holdings. But what would Lamprey say? What could he say? Just how much did he know? Suddenly, Charlie had an inspiration. He'd call Inman, or go see him. He'd tell him the dangers presented by this whole business. Elizabeth herself might be at risk. He was going to make an appearance with the mayor at a press conference to defuse the situation until a real investigation could be made. What he would be doing would be as much for Elizabeth, Ellen, and him, Inman, as anybody else. The high road. The business interests way in a town like Atlanta. The Atlanta way. The only trouble was, as he made this little speech inside his head, he tried to picture Inman right in front of him. He tried to picture Inman judiciously taking this all into account, and finally nodding yes. The only trouble was he couldn't picture Inman doing anything judicious in this situation. He might get as far as defuse the situation, and then he'd learn something about fuses and explosions, all right. So the tornado spun and spun and spun inside his skull.
"Charlie?"
asked Serena in a sweet, reasonable voice.
How bad can it be to tell the truth?
Even with Durwood as his guide, Durwood was so taciturn it came across as a bitterness toward life, Conrad immediately sensed the staggering scale upon which life was lived at Turpentine. The stable, which was grander than any building in the entire city of Pittsburgh, California, housed 59 horses. What could anybody do with 59 horses? There was a snake house for snakes, and a breeding barn just for mating horses. There were kennels for 40 dogs. There were employees all over the place. And if the subject of Charlie Croker came up, they invariably referred to him as Cap'n Charlie. Once he returned to the big house, he helped the old man upstairs to a bedroom, another guest room by the looks of it. The old man was already getting around much better on his aluminum crutches, so much so that Conrad suggested that he try just an aluminum cane. But he wasn't having any of that. He was determined to stick with the crutches. Clack, 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 clack. With Conrad's help, Mr. Croker deposited himself in an easy chair near the bed. He was breathing too rapidly, and sweat had broken out on his forehead. He looked up at Conrad the way a disobedient student might look up at a teacher.
"I think I did too much," he said.
"Well, remember what we were talking about, Mr. Croker," said Conrad. "Much as you've been in bed, you're going to be weak when you try to walk."
"Pour me a glass of water there, if you don't mind," said the old man.
He downed almost half the tumbler at one gulp and went,
"Phew!"
Then he looked up at Conrad again.
"I'll tell you something I need worse than water."
He paused.
I'm talking about the book.
All right, said Conrad. Where is it?
He looked about and then spotted it. It was on a bureau. Conrad picked up the Stoics and then stood facing Mr. Croker, who had by now sunk so deeply into the easy chair he was all but supine.
What would you like to know, Mr. Croker?
All right, said Mr. Croker. Suppose you've been asked to say something publicly that isn't literally true, but is more nearly true than if you said the opposite.
He hesitated and looked at Conrad and said,
"Do you follow me so far?"
"Not completely," said Conrad, "but go ahead."
"But if you say this, you're going to lose a lot of friends. Maybe all your friends. But if you don't say it, you're going to lose all your money. And you'll still lose your friends because there's no way you can separate their friendship toward you from the fact that you have a certain place in society, which you wouldn't have in the first place without your money."
"I can tell you what Epictetus says," said Conrad. "He says no one can make progress facing both ways."
"Where does he say that?"
The old man began to sit up straighter.
"I can't remember exactly, Mr. Croker. I think it's in Book 4. But anyway, he says you can't be both a Stoic and a man who's liked by all his friends. Half the time they like you because you share their bad habits. Now, if you exercise self-control and self-respect, they'll shake their heads and say, 'He's just not himself anymore.'"
The old man was nodding his head in vigorous assent.
"Oh, that's exactly it," he said in a low voice. "That's exactly it."
"But, Mr. Croker, do you mind if I ask you something?"
"No, go ahead."
"This is the second time you've mentioned making a public statement about somebody. Couldn't you be a little more specific?"
"I'm sort of confused, Mr. Croker. You were talking about something that isn't literally true, but is more nearly true than if you said the opposite. Can you give me an example?"
The old man hung his head forward and then looked up again at Conrad. "All right," he said, "I'm going to tell you exactly what's going on. You're not going to believe it, but I swear to God it's true. Incidentally, or not so incidentally, this is just between us. Okay, Connie?"
"Yes, sir. You have my word."
"I don't even know you," said the old man. "All the same, I trust you. Maybe it's because you don't know my friends. Anyway, I trust you. Do you remember the first time we talked about Epictetus and the Stoics, and I said something to you about dilemmas?"
Conrad nodded yes.
"And you told me a story about Agrippinus and, what was his name, the historian?"
"Florus," said Conrad.
"Florus. Well, now I'm going to tell you about a dilemma. My own. You're going to be surprised. I'm going to tell you everything."
The boy cocked his head and looked at Charlie in such a curious way for so long, Charlie snapped his fingers in front of his face, as if to say, "Snap out of it."
"Well, Mr. Croker," said the boy, "in that case, I'm going to tell you everything, and you're going to be even more surprised. I don't know any more about you than you know about me, but I trust you, too. If I can't, I'm in a lot of trouble."
They started talking, both of them, and they held nothing back, nothing at all. It turned dark outside, and still they talked. Twice Mason came up and knocked on the door and told them dinner was ready, and then Serena came up to tell them, but they kept on talking. It was about 10:15 when Charlie said,
"Connie, by the way, I'm going to have to keep on calling you Connie. Conrad just don't fit. I couldn't have had nobody named Conrad working in one of those damn freezer units. I'm sorry. Anyway, I've made a decision. I'm going to the press conference. That's my test.
I'm glad, said Conrad. Remember Agrippinus, the Stoic, who refused to act in Nero's play?
Yeah.
I don't think I ever mentioned what happened to him. Several friends came by his house, and they told him, "Your trial's going on right now in the Senate." Agrippina says, "Oh? That's their business. It's time for me to take my exercise." Then he singles out one of his friends and says, "Come on, let's go exercise and then take a cold bath." So that's what he does. When he gets back to the house, more people are there, and they're saying, "They've reached a verdict." And Agrippina says, "Which is?" "Guilty." Agrippina says, "What's the sentence? Death or exile?" They answer, "Exile." Agrippina says, "My property, confiscated or not?" They answer, "Confiscated." "Thank you," says Agrippinus. Then he turns to his friend. "It's time for dinner. Let's go dine at Acacia." Which they did. Charlie, there was a man. Chapter 32. The Manager. The Last Chapter. The camera pulled way, way, way back. How do they do these things, Peep Gas wondered. Until on the television screen in Martha's library appeared a long shot of the City Hall rotunda from above. All the gray and white marble. The marble walls. The marble balcony with its gleaming brass railing. The lower part of the rotunda's great pantheon-like marble dome. The marble floor. In the middle of the floor, a marble fountain. Off to the left, the window where you could pay your utility bills, if you had to. And Peep Gas had had to do exactly that more than once, scramble to that damned window with cash at the 11th hour to avoid having his electricity cut off. Beyond the fountain was an enormous crescent, almost a semicircle, of television cameras. Looked like 2 or 3 dozen of them. And beyond the cameras, a mass of chairs filled with journalists. And beyond the journalists, a short flight of stairs leading up to a marble landing from whence the rotunda's 2 grand marble staircases led up to the 2nd level. More masses of humanity were sitting on the stairs, as if they were tiers at a stadium. The landing itself was like a stage or a dais. On it were a modernistic blonde wood podium, looked like maple or ash, and behind the podium, one on each side, a pair of stout banker's chairs, apparently made of the same wood. The podium was no doubt where the mayor would be holding forth. Peep Gas looked at his watch. "It's already 11:05, he said to Martha. And then to Wallace. "Have you seen one of these before? One of these press conferences?"
"No, I haven't," Wallace said dully.
When he moved in here, Peep Gas had never considered the fact that now that it was June, the boy, Wallace, would be home from school. It was damned awkward. Peep Gas never knew what to say to the boy, and the boy never seemed to want to say anything to him. For a flickering instant he thought of his own 2 boys, whom he hardly ever saw any more. But quickly enough he returned to Martha, young Wallace, and Valley Road. In the real Buckhead. Only Martha seemed comfortable about it all. Without taking her eyes off the screen, she said, "Oh, these things never start on time." But she was thinking of something else. To watch television, Ray always gravitated to the same easy chair that had been Charlie's favorite. That was the only way she could think of in which the 2 men were alike. Now, no more rotunda on the TV screen.
Instead, a man and a woman seated side by side behind some sort of futuristic TV news desk. An inch or so of coiled, translucent wire was unfortunately visible behind the left ear of the man, whose name was Roland Barris. He also had a hair problem. His hair had receded badly on either side, leaving a forelock at the front of his pate separated like an island from the mainland. The forelock had been artfully teased and brushed back and then sprayed, so that it reconnected with the mainland, if only for the duration of a broadcast. "You poor bastard," thought Peepgas, with a satisfying schadenfreude. "You'll never make it to the network nightly news anchor desk, not with that scarce-haired skull of yours." He decided not to mention it to Martha, however, for fear of underscoring the fact that his own career in banking had nowhere to go either. "The poor man," thought Martha, studying Roland Barris. "He's had a complete dye job, every hair on his head. That always looks awful on a man, because it's so obvious." She decided not to mention it to Ray, however, since it was not in her interest as an eternal blonde to bring up the matter of who did or didn't have a complete dye job. The woman on the screen, the anchorette or whatever, Lynn Hinkle, was a good 15 years younger than Roland Barris. Her main journalistic assets, thought Martha, were her pretty face and her head of straight blonde hair. Naturally blonde, no doubt. "And how fast it goes, my dear, you just wait." "Waiting for Mayor Jordan," Roland Barris was saying, "who has never held a press conference that has aroused more intense speculation. But then this is an unusual situation all the way round, wouldn't you say so, Lynn?" "I certainly would," said Blondie, smiling instinctively and utterly inappropriately. "No one we've talked to at City Hall can remember a mayor of Atlanta ever holding a press conference to address an alleged sexual assault, particularly in a case where no charges have been filed, Roland." "That's a good point, Lynn," said Roland, without so much as a glance toward Lynn, as if his eyes had been magnetized by the camera. "Sources close to the mayor have told us that what the mayor has been concerned about has been a mini-riot that erupted in Farik Fannin's old neighborhood, English Avenue, last week. Over on English Avenue and much of South Atlanta, many people look upon Farik Fannin as one of their own, who has risen to national prominence as an All-American running back. And now they feel he's been set up and framed. Or that's what many people believe, Lynn."
"That's about the size of it, Roland," said Lynn, without looking at Roland. "And, of course, the entire case has taken on racial overtones, and that's what must be paramount."
She broke off the sentence and cocked her head slightly, and for a moment appeared to be gazing toward some place far, far away.
"I think the mayor has appeared, and so we now rejoin Joe Mundy at City Hall."
For just an instant, there was Joe Mundy talking into a microphone up on the balcony of the rotunda. "That's right, Lynn, Mayor Jordan." Joe Mundy was younger than Roland Barris, but he had an unfortunate pair of ears that stuck way out on either side. "You loser," thought Peepgas, stroking his own full head of thatchy, light brown hair. "You'll never even make it into the studio in Atlanta. They'll leave you out there in the field until you get an ear job." On the screen was a medium shot of Mayor Wesley Dobbs Jordan walking up the short flight of stairs toward the landing. The camera angle was from the rear. "And toward the podium," the voice of Joe Mundy was saying. The camera stayed on the mayor, then suddenly returned to the stairs. Now you saw the back of a big, bald, white man laboriously climbing the stairs by leaning upon the shoulder of a slender young white man wearing a navy polo shirt and khaki pants, who walked at his side. There was an awkward pause on the telecast as the camera stayed fixed upon the gimping old man's progress. Not a peep from Mr. Joe Mundy, who evidently didn't know who this burly old man was.
"Look, Mom," said Wallace, "that's Dad."
Roger's seat in the front row had been assigned so that he would be looking directly at Croker as he sat in his banker's chair on the landing
waiting for Wes to introduce him. Roger intended to give Croker the eye, the accusing, threatening, bankrupting eye, the entire time, to make sure he came through with his part of the morning's recitation. Two seats away from Roger, here in the front row, was Croker's wife, Serena. "I wonder if she's even half his age," thought Roger. "She's a number, and I bet she's trouble." With her short skirt, she had a way of crossing her legs that was enough to drive you crazy. But practically every other seat in the place was given over to the press, the usual pack of shaggy mutts. At this moment a tremendous buzz was running through the pack. Some wondered why on earth the big developer, Charlie Croker, had come in gimping from the wings, unannounced, to accompany the mayor as he delivered some sort of homily on racial unrest in Atlanta. Others saw this big, hulking white man using a young white man as a crutch, and wondered who these people were and why they were here. Croker leaned heavily on the boy's shoulder and grimaced as he climbed the stairs up to the landing. He clung tightly to the boy's hand for support as he lowered himself into one of the ashwood banker's chairs. He sat there panting and red in the face, with his bad leg, the right leg, stiff as a length of lumber.